This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The NFL season is underway thanks to the New England Patriots, the Oakland Raiders, the Rolling Stones, Ozzy Osbourne, and a cast of thousands. Check that. Cast of millions here to discuss the rest of the 2005 NFL campaign, and perhaps even Green Day, Santana, and who knows, Santana Moss, no relation, is Paul Attner, a senior writer for the Sporting News. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. I wonder where Santana's going to finish this year. What do you...
We must watch, and so then we will know.
He might be ahead of the 49ers. I don't know.
Well, there has been much speculation over whether the Patriots can achieve what no NFL team ever has, namely three Super Bowl wins in a row. What does Thursday's opening night 30-20 win over the Raiders tell you about that possibility?
Well, they certainly were very impressive. You know, they start off terribly, and then went up from there and showed me some defensive work and offensive play from Brady, which I thought looked smoother than last year. And so, yeah, all of a sudden, you know, they don't seem to be the team on the decline as maybe I even thought before that game. But, you know, as they say in the locker room, there's a long season ahead of us here, Bill. So we'll have to see. Because just, you know, let them go on the road, and we'll see what happens when they play away from a place they can't seem to lose anymore.
Some brave and perhaps imaginative souls have predicted a Colts victory in the AFC Championship game. Haven't those prognosticators seen Peyton Manning flinch every time someone mentions the name Brady or Belichick?
That's me. I mean, I'm one of those guys.
Pick
the Colts. Yeah, but I think what's going to happen is that the Colts are going to win their regular season game against the Patriots for the first time in recent memory, and therefore it will have home field advantage, and therefore the Patriots will be the ones flinching in the championship game. But that all does hinge on that one game, which the Colts have not been able to win yet, and I think this year they're just enough better to be able to do it.
Is there a dark horse AFC team that you can think of that might make it to the Super Bowl or at least spoil the postseason plans of the other elite teams in the conference?
You know, not in the AFC. I think there are some teams like Baltimore, Houston that will get into the playoffs that did not last year. The Ravens maybe fall into that category that you're talking about that could play well enough if they get enough play out of their quarterback, Kyle Bowler. It could go to the Super Bowl, but I'm not sure if you look at them as a dark horse since they've always been around the playoffs for years.
Okay, Paul, Philadelphia quiz time. The Eagles' talented but erratic wide receiver Terrell Owens is back after much offseason zaniness. So, will the Eagles A, succeed with him, B, win despite his presence, C, fail because of him, D, relocate to Salt Lake City and hope that he doesn't notice, or E, other?
I don't know if I can remember A, B, or C yet.
you can always play it safe and say all of the above.
That's right. Well, I mean, what's going to happen there is that if he stays healthy and plays the whole season, they go back to the Super Bowl. But he will be disruptive, Bill. In the locker room where none of us will see it, he will be incredibly disruptive like he was in San Francisco. And eventually the Eagles, like San Francisco, run out of patience and they will get rid of him. But that will not happen this year.
The Vikings, Falcons, and Rams have been mentioned as NFC teams worth betting on. I'm sorry, rooting for. Do you agree?
Yes, I do, and I think the Vikings certainly are a team. You know, I hate to use the cliche, fall on the radar, but I will because I'm a sports writer. So, you know, they fall under the radar, and no one is really talking about the Vikings. But I think that the Vikings did a wonderful job in the offseason by getting rid of Randy Moss, who's, again, another locker room detriment. And also they improve their defense. And I think that they are a lot happier team without Moss, and therefore I think they're going to be a better team. So it's a team bear watching.
The New Orleans Saints will play their first scheduled home game against the Giants on September 19th in New York, rather than at the Superdome, of course. And now late word that they will play four games in San Antonio and perhaps three in Baton Rouge. Could Saints ownership have been a bit more proactive about their 2005 schedule and other matters as well?
No, you're asking Tom Benson to be proactive, and I think he's lucky if he can think from one day to the next. He just has a problem embracing a reality, starting with his proposed decision not to refund season ticket holders of the Saints their money this year because they weren't going to play any home games in New Orleans. The league squashed that one. So we can never anticipate any original thinking, Bill, from the Saints ownership. But that's about as good as they could get anyway. Baton Rouge, where they want to play the rest of their home games, is not ready yet to host the Saints or, for that matter, the LSU Tigers. And so San Antonio is a good alternative. And then when Baton Rouge is ready, I think it's good that the league has said, you know, hopefully they've said, let's we'll play those games if we can in Baton Rouge.
The NFL recently canceled a meeting with the Players Association scheduled for next Tuesday and Wednesday in Atlanta. The two sides were to discuss an extension of the existing labor agreement, without which owners face the prospect of the so-called uncapped year for the 2007 season. If such a horror does transpire, what will NFL rosters and payrolls look like without a cap?
You will see utter chaos. I mean, you really will, because there are owners, Dan Snyder comes to mind immediately, that are willing to spend money blindly, and players that have are free agents that year will be subjected to great bidding wars, and you're going to see great roster upheaval because they haven't had the ability to do that for a long time, and there's a lot of itchy trigger fingers, or I guess check-writing fingers, that are waiting for that year to take place. So the league does not want that to happen, which is why ultimately they will come to some resolution on this labor situation.
Paul, you have written about the last XXIII Super Bowls, so picking Super Bowl XL opponents, winner and exact score, should be a piece of cake, right?
That's right, and every year we do this, and every year you remind
it's
me in January.
It's okay because nobody remembers.
But
it's
you
September.
Do. You're the one person in America that does. The two teams will be the Colts and the Eagles, mm-hmm. and the Colts will prevail, let's say, 34-24.
Paul Lattner is a senior writer at the Sporting News, and he gazes into his excellent crystal pigskin each fall and winter for only a game. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Bill.
In women's semifinal action at the U.S. Open yesterday, Mary Pierce beat Elena Dementieva, and Kim Clijsters outlasted Maria Sharapova. Pierce and Clijsters will face each other for the title this evening. Today in the men's semis, Roger Federer takes on Leighton Hewitt, and unseeded Robbie Ginepri will try to oust Andre Agassi. Also yesterday, the American Bryan brothers bested top seeds Jonas Bjorkman and Max Marini to win the men's doubles final and the $400,000 first prize. And on Sunday, Elena Dementieva and Flavia Panetta vie for the same spoils against Lisa Raymond and Samantha Stosur. You may not know all those players, even with a program, and as Ron Schachter reports, doubles specialists are a threatened subspecies.
On a sunny afternoon last weekend, Mike and Bob Bryan held court in round two of the U.S. Open. These 27-year-old identical twins from California are the world's second-ranked men's doubles team. As singles players, neither Bryan could crack the top 100, but together they've climbed the doubles ladder and earned nearly $3 million apiece. They are the newest generation of specialists who have raised doubles play to an unprecedented level. They're also attracting fans like Gwen Allen and Jill Russell, who could have been watching higher-profile singles matches here.
We play more doubles, so you can identify with the doubles a little better than the singles, perhaps. Just looking at the teamwork, you just learn a lot from watching it.
I like to watch the net game, and that's more appealing to me, and I see more strategy in doubles than in singles. It's more fun.
Canadian Daniel Nestor shared the men's doubles title at last year's U.S. Open, and says that doubles has shed its reputation as a sideshow because it's a great game in its own right.
Doubles is a different game than singles, and it's different skills. You know, it's quick reflexes, precision shots at the net. It's, you know, faster points with power shots, and every point's different in doubles.
Australian Renee Stubbs, who's won four Grand Slam titles, says she has something that singles players just can't match.
You know, when I walk into the court and play some singles players, I don't hit the ball anywhere near as well as they do. But I am smarter than them. I volley way better than them. My hands are better than theirs. And I know how to read the ball off the racket a lot better than them.
That combination has kept Martina Navratilova, a world-class doubles player at almost 49 years old. And she's continued to win. In fact, Navratilova's 174 doubles crowns have eclipsed her 167 singles championships. And she made it to the semifinals in this year's Open.
I can still play. I don't have to cover the whole court. You know, the same things that enabled me to play doubles well 20 years ago, they're still holding now.
But these players and their boosters are in a distinct minority. A few hundred yards away from where the Bryans are wowing the crowd, Virginia Ruano Pascual, the world's top-ranked women's doubles player and three-time defending U.S. Open champ, plays before fewer than 500 spectators. She won't be featured at a post-match press conference, and you won't see her highlights on ESPN. And if you don't know Spain's Ruano Pascual, you're not alone. Even though she's dominated women's doubles for most of her 9-year partnership with Argentinian Paula Suarez, it's taken almost that long just to get noticed in her homeland, which prefers its great singles players.
The TV and the newspaper, they follow us now more now. But at the beginning, it's only concentrating the singles. So for me, it was tough.
That anonymity doesn't surprise Renee Stubbs.
If my doubles tournaments and titles had been shown on television through the years, I would be a star. But, of course, doubles is not shown on television. So players and people and fans tend to go with people that they see on TV. They see Serena, they see Venus, they see Kim Clijsters, Davenport. They're stars to them. They're not so much tennis players. They don't necessarily want to go and see them hit the tennis ball. They want to see the tennis player, the star. They want to see Andre Agassi, the star.
Stubbs says that the Women's Tennis Association and the ATP, which runs the men's tour, need to promote doubles more aggressively and take advantage of the fact that a large percentage of tennis fans play doubles themselves. In the meantime, there's more doubles trouble brewing on the men's side, where the ATP has just revamped its doubles format. In order to speed up matches, there will be a streamlined scoring system. Each set will extend to only 5 games instead of the usual 6. And a tiebreaker will come into play when a set is tied at 4. The new ATP rules also will replace many doubles regulars with more recognizable singles players. And Bob Bryan says that he and other tennis tandems are in a struggle to keep their jobs.
The doubles players have been discriminated against for a long time. We've just been giving up a little bit here and there. We let singles players into the draw. We cut our prize money, gave it to the singles players, and we haven't got anything in return. We've not been promoted. You can't even find doubles players in the programs. We're scrubbed from the tour. I mean, it's hard to find us. So we're asking for like a doubles bill of rights.
And last week, besides vying for the doubles crown, the Bryans filed a lawsuit, along with dozens of other players, to stop the ATP from making its planned changes. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Flushing Meadows.
It's 19 minutes past... I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, post-punk rehab through baseball. But first, journal entry, Monday, September 6th, 2005, a day for climbing. And so, from a break in the woods in Foster, Rhode Island, I undertook the ascent of Gerimuth Hill to the highest point in the Ocean State. At a turn in the trail, I encountered two other intrepid climbers, Kathy and Ray Bissette. In Ray, I noted what seemed to be the troubling first stages of exhaustion.
Yeah, I was looking for a pub or something. I don't see one here, no.
I did my best to keep his spirits up.
Well, get ready, because this is the summit coming up here.
Oh, my God.
Wow. You got something?
Yep, if you go over and stand on this rock, you will,
in
fact, have summited. And I think the record should show that you did this in sandals.
Right, right.
Both of you did this in sandals. All right, stay there. I got to get a picture.
What a beautiful day.
It was, in fact, a beautiful day as we all stood on the rock at the highest point in Rhode Island, the culmination of a good 3.5-minute walk. Stoney Burke, one of the members of the High Pointers Club, who was serving as a host at Gerimuth Hill, explained that the Bissettes and I weren't the first visitors to be surprised at the ease with which one can reach the state's summit, 812 feet above sea level.
I don't know what people expected when they came back here, but sometimes they would actually put on full backpacks and hiking sticks and hiking boots, and they thought it was going to be quite a trek to get up here to this rock. And obviously they'd become disappointed after about a 2-minute walk in the woods. So they would stand on that rock and do just the big hero, Superman kind of shot, and make kind of a joke about the whole thing. And a couple of people actually went back and would get their ice axes and then come back and get a summit shot that way.
Actually, the ascent of Gerimuth Hill has not always been comically simple. Until just a few months ago, the people who owned the property abutting Route 101 and extending into the woods, property those who seek the highest point in Rhode Island must cross, were hostile to the idea. Officials in the High Pointers Club, a group of people who delight in climbing to the highest points in various states, had to limit their Rhode Island adventures to a few designated holiday weekends. Gene Trousdale, visiting Jerimuth Hill from Norman, Oklahoma, is a high-pointing veteran of those bad old days.
Oh, yes. It was very difficult. People got chased. People got hollered at. People got shot at. It was not...
Got shot at?
Well, I don't think they were high-pointers, and I don't really know the whole story, but yeah.
Just a couple of months ago, Jeff and Debbie Mosley bought the property. They have maintained an open trail policy on weekends, and last weekend they were out in the woods with a dozen or so members of the High Pointers Club improving the trail. As far as High Pointer Gene Trousdale is concerned, the Mosleys are a blessing.
They came up to our convention the other night, and they got quite a round of applause and a standing ovation because everybody knows how difficult this has been. In fact, for a long time, it counted if you stopped on the highway out in front of the house because it couldn't get in here.
Gene Trousdale has climbed to the high points of 42 states. A cranky knee will probably prevent her from reaching a 43rd, but on Monday, accompanied by her golden retriever Penny, she participated enthusiastically in grooming the trail up Jerimuth Hill and proudly showed me a tattoo on her leg of the High Pointers logo. Trousdale also serves as the club's marketeer.
They call me Mother Merc because the name of my store is the High Pointers Mercantile. We sell T-shirts and sweatshirts and books and hiking books and other cool stuff.
And, of course, once you've accomplished a certain number of high points, you get your plaques and your pins and
right.
all the rest. That
right.
all come from you as well?
That's right, yeah. I handle the five-point patches and pins for 25, 30, 40, 48, and the big one for 50. And then... also, 50 completers. Their pin is free, but if they want to order a plaque, it's a beautiful plaque indicating they've got 50 high points.
According to club records, only about 140 of the 3,000 high pointers have reached the highest point in all 50 states, which requires summiting Alaska's Mount McKinley and Mount Rainier in Washington State, among other challenges. John Mitchler, a co-director of the club who lives in Golden, Colorado, has earned his plaque. I couldn't help but ask him if ascending the lump alongside Highway 101 in Rhode Island didn't feel a little silly after the climbs he'd made in Alaska and elsewhere.
Actually, sometimes it's just the opposite. It's more fun. It's you get and you see an easy one, and it's sort of a relief instead of a large western mountain or a difficult New England hike. It's easy, and you actually enjoy the high point rather than the hiking.
John's wife, Kathy, was with him in Rhode Island. Though she has only climbed to the tops of five states, she has been to the highest points in every county in Florida and Vermont. She says the attraction is less the feeling of accomplishment than the opportunity to discover something wherever she goes. On a recent business trip, she sought out the highest point in Brooklyn, New York.
It's actually on a cemetery, a famous cemetery that, heavens, I would never think to go to. I think you get used to just always thinking about a high pointing, and you tend to be more active, you know, but it's a learning experience. A lot of education in all of this.
Education and surprises, too, some of which reveal the humor to which high pointers are partial. For example, imagine, if you will, the most dangerous journey to a high point. Would it be one in which the weather at the top of a mountain might suddenly plunge 50 degrees, one known for punishing winds or treacherously slippery rocks? Not according to Gary White of Double Springs, Alabama, whose first high point was in the state he now calls home.
Mount Cheeha.
Mount Cheeha.
That's a big mountain
compared
to this one.
Well, it's a...
At 2,407 feet above sea level, Mount Cheeha is bigger than Jerimuth Hill. But Gary White sheepishly admits that reaching Alabama's high point requires no hiking at all. You can drive to the top of it, and the marker's right behind the Welcome Center. White has 43 high points to his credit, and he has climbed in Washington and Wyoming, but the most dangerous high point, he says it's no contest.
Well, most people think the most dangerous high point is probably Delaware, because the fact that it's at the middle of a street intersection.
So you hike in there, you got to be watching what you're doing.
Watch
semi might come by.
Right, a lot bigger than a high pointer running over you.
Actually, high pointers are unlikely to run over anybody. Those gathered in Rhode Island following their convention in New Hampshire last weekend didn't seem especially interested in competition. Each happily acknowledged the accomplishments of the others. All of them celebrated the fact that the trail up Jerimuth Hill was open on weekends rather than closed almost all the time. Everybody seemed utterly happy cutting brush, raking stones on the path, or working to mount a mailbox beside the rock at the top of Rhode Island.
Kenny, are you ready to go work? Come on. Okay.
Wrecking Crew, subtitled The Really Bad News Griffith Park Pirates, is a book about a baseball team in the sense that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is the story of a group of men who occasionally play basketball and go fishing together. John Albert, the author, confesses that he's damaged goods and takes responsibility for the damage done, and he's one of the less self-destructive members of the Griffith Park Pirates, which may be the most tolerant and inclusive nine ever assembled. John Albert joins me now from NPR West. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks so much.
How and why were the Pirates formed?
Well, the Pirates were formed because of one person, which was Mike Coulter. And he was in a band called Lifter, who was signed just after the success of Nirvana. And they were a fairly good band, but probably didn't sell that many records. And his band was on the way out. And he had always loved baseball. And so I think he saw it as some sort of salvation. Mm. And he sort of roped the rest of us into it.
All athletes have distractions, of course. But the distractions your teammates face include drug addiction, a hopeless love affair with a stripper, an equally hopeless love affair with a call girl, the compulsion to wear women's clothing, suicidal neighbors. Have I left anything out?
Well, besides the convicted murderer, we had someone who had been in a fairly successful rock band, somebody who had been in a not-so-successful rock band. I had played drums in Bad Religion, which is a fairly well-known punk band, at their lowest point. We had Johnny Navarro, who most people identify because his cousin is famous, but Johnny is, in his own right, an incredibly entertaining and charismatic person. Appropriate to it being a Los Angeles story, we have two struggling actors, one being from Japan and the other being from the Appalachian Mountains. And both of them arrive in Los Angeles.
Each equipped with great language skills.
Yeah, both hampered in their own way, right. And both sort of, in a way, culturally unprepared for what Los Angeles is, which is a really isolating, competitive place. As I say in the book, it's a place where if one doesn't realize their dreams fully, you're looked upon as a failure. And I think that's one of the really harsh parts of the town.
Did you know from your first acquaintance with all of your teammates that there was a book in the Pirates?
Absolutely not. These were all my friends. And for a long time, you know, I was a struggling screenwriter looking for stories, and I never saw the story that was right in front of me. It wasn't until I was having a meal and telling somebody about my baseball team and they were laughing and telling me what a great story it was that I even thought that there was maybe something there. I think when you grow up and all your friends are so strange all along, you don't sort of see it as anything interesting.
I had to admit the simple act of playing catch felt good. This is a sentence that appears just a few pages into Wrecking Crew, but it's fair to say that even that humble catch doesn't end entirely happily,
no.
Right?
No, but it's in an ugly way, it's very therapeutic. You know, we were playing catch sort of out of desperation, and I think that's sort of a theme that runs throughout the book, is that we're trying desperately to capture something that we either were denied or ran away from, which was a sort of an innocence of growing up. I mean, so many of us had tried to grow up so fast and with such horrifying consequences that I think that was the first step in sort of going back and reclaiming that.
For the benefit of those who haven't read the book, you're
going to have to
tell us how that catch ends.
Well, it ends with Mike vomiting into the alley. Yeah, he was suffering the effects of drug withdrawal, and but he still had this desire to not only play catch but to pitch. And so we were in the alley and we were playing catch, and he had me squat down and he threw a couple fairly decent pitches, and then I threw the ball back to him, and by the time that it was a couple of feet from him, he had already sort of stumbled over and was vomiting. But, you know, it was still fun.
How did you guys ever win?
Well, it wasn't because we were tremendously good athletes. I think one of the things that happened was that when we won a game, the feeling was so good that we wanted more, much in the same way that most of us have become addicted to drugs. So where other teams took it for granted, we didn't, and we practiced over and over again. And I would go to the batting cages at 12 noon in the 100-degree heat and just hit balls over and over and over again. And we had one good season in us, and we won that season.
You write that you and your teammates had, quote, identified yourselves as angry young rebels, but the reality was our time had come and gone. Did baseball help you recapture your time or just come to terms with the fact that it was over?
It didn't help us recapture our time, for sure. And I don't know if everyone on the team knows their time has come and passed. I certainly do. I think what it did was allow us to live in the present. We were caught in that sort of midway point in life where we were either reliving the past or looking to the future and some event that was going to rescue us. And playing baseball on a team every Sunday, and for some reason baseball specifically, allowed us to just live in the moment. And, you know, when we were playing together, nothing else mattered. And I think that was one of the most healing aspects of the whole thing.
Now, Masachi, your Japanese teammate, is a legitimate player. He learned the game well in Japan.
Right.
And there are a couple of other guys who had played in high school until they got kicked off the team for various things. But is it fair to say that a lot of the original Griffith Park Pirates were essentially imposters?
Yeah, I don't think anyone would have mistaken us for legitimate baseball players at first. But I think we had skills that compensated. You know, I don't think we cared about our own welfare, which actually helps sometimes in baseball. And we had an obsessive and aggressive sort of team spirit. We were playing against people that had played in high school and some actually in college and some in the minor leagues. So we were outmatched in terms of experience.
I mentioned the tolerance level of the Pirates organization, such as it was.
Yes.
Give our listeners an idea of what players could get away with and still remain on the roster.
Everything. I think if they showed up for a game, they were still on the roster. One of our better players revealed himself to be a lifelong cross-dresser, and I believe he thought that he would be off the team, but I think everyone sort of rejoiced in the fact. And
he was discreet about what he dressed in on the field. He restricted himself to women's underwear when he was actually on the field, right?
Right, right. We knew, and he would occasionally show us his latest thong that he was wearing. You have to understand that he's not a petite nor pretty. Well, I don't want to say that. I think when he's dressed, he would probably consider himself pretty. But he's a very masculine, tough guy. And so the contrast is kind of entertaining.
I'm curious about how some of your teammates or ex-teammates feel about the way that you've presented them in Wrecking Crew.
Strangely enough, they're incredibly fine with it. I asked them after I'd written the book, I went back and asked each one of them if they wanted their real names used. And I think they would have been angry if I hadn't used their names. You know, you have to understand that for almost all of these people, it's no secret that they've led these incredibly destructive and self-destructive lives. So it's not going to surprise anybody that they know, including their families. But I think that they wanted some acknowledgement for their lives, like a lot of people.
This leads me to another question. You have realized one of your dreams pretty fully. I mean, you can hold Wrecking Crew in your hand. It's a published book, and it's been optioned
right.
for the movies. Do your teammates
right.
resent your success, or are they happy for you?
Well, I'll just tell you this, that when I have a reading here in town, they not only show up, but they wear parts of their uniforms, and then they heckle me. But I think they really love it. You know, I mean, we are still a team, and I think they see my success as theirs as well.
John Albert is the author of Wrecking Crew, The Really Bad News, Griffith Park Pirates, published by Scribner's. He joined me from NPR West. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Show me something more than it.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the dirtiest game in town. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
I don't know who's going to win the U.S. Open tennis tournament, but I can't see how the finalists, whoever they are, will create a better match than Andre Agassi and James Blake played on Wednesday night and early Thursday morning. Can you?
No, there's only you get one or two of these per tournament, and this is you get one or two of these per decade. You know, 7-6 and a tiebreaker in the fifth at the U.S. Open, ending at like 1 o'clock in the morning. That's what makes the tournament, because everybody down there hangs in there till one shot.
It's kind of refreshing to have had a reason to care about men's tennis.
Well, not only that, but a brief shout out should go to Robbie Ginepri, who beat Guillermo Coria in the afternoon in another 5-set match that ended 7-5. That was a terrific match in and of itself.
It's a small matter, Charlie, in the light of all the devastation and sadness in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, but several Louisiana college teams recently announced which fields and gyms they would be calling home this fall. And it seems that campuses in Texas have been especially hospitable.
Yeah, the Louisiana Tech and Texas A&M are putting up some teams. The Tulane football team went to Jackson, Mississippi the day before it hit, and then they were bussed to SMU in Dallas, which is where they've been ever since. Eventually, they're going to wind up at Louisiana Tech, where 88 players are going to go to school, live, and practice for the fall semester. One of the interesting ones is Southern Mississippi, which was housing itself at the University of Memphis. Of course, Southern Mississippi plays the University of Memphis at the end of the season.
We spoke last week about the NBA Players Association donating money to the relief effort underway on the Gulf Coast. Stephon Marbury stands out among the many pro athletes who have made large contributions.
Yeah, the first thing we heard from New Orleans was don't send stuff, don't send people, send money. Stephon Marbury, who has no connection really to New Orleans that I'm aware of, he's born in New York, played in Phoenix, and now plays for the Knicks, has contributed somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million so far.
My favorite headline of the week goes as follows. Shaq family head massive Katrina relief effort. Of what other kind of effort would Shaq be capable?
He doesn't.
Massive.
He doesn't do anything small. Yeah, you know, of course, he went to LSU. He essentially grew up in Louisiana when he was in college, since it was the closest thing to a permanent home he had, because he'd been raised on Army bases around the world. He canceled the golf tournament. He's going to spend several days down there. He's going to try to assist with relief efforts. I hope he doesn't try to take on the deputy sheriff persona he's done for giggles out in L.A. and then later in Miami. But, he's setting up collection boxes in Miami to ask for contributions of toiletries and personal health items. As we said last week, not that it's anywhere near the most important part of the ongoing catastrophe, but this is a catastrophe that hits America, a lot of America's athletes, in a very unique way, because so many of them are from the huge affected area.
Hmm. The Connecticut Sun take a one-game lead into today's Game 2 of the WNBA Eastern Conference semifinals. Are you excited about the possibility of a pro basketball final in this area for the first time in nearly two decades?
A pro basketball final on the northern East Coast, yes. Of course, what you may wind up having is a replay of at least the travel of the great L.A.-Boston finals of the 80s, because you're going to wind up perhaps with Sacramento playing Connecticut.
It's a possibility. This week, record-setting NFL receiver Jerry Rice, 42, bid adieu to football. Are you among those who regard that decision as a little overdue?
Yeah, I mean, maybe by a year, maybe by two. I mean, give him credit for not wanting to hang on with Denver as a kind of fourth receiver icon, grand old man. At the end of the day, when it's finally assessed, Jerry Rice is one of the few people in the conversation with Jim Brown.
Are you among those who applaud Carolina Panthers running back Rod Smart for his remarkable ability to turn hate into love?
Yes, first of all, the very fact that Rod Smart, known as He Hate Me in the late lamented XFL, has an ongoing NFL career proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is a great nation. But now Rod, who's always been a step ahead of the game in terms of marketing, has now going to go by He Love Me, because, as he said, he came to Carolina and got my love. And there's a James Taylor song in there somewhere.
Absolutely. In the planning ahead department, Los Angeles will apparently bid for the 2016 Olympic Games. Good idea?
No! Stop! I was there in 1984. You don't want to do it again. Keep the Olympics overseas.
Lance Armstrong confused his handlers as well as the public for a while this week. Then he announced that he would be back in training with the Discovery team this winter. Apparently, he just has no tolerance for rest and relaxation.
Well, this is turning into one of those Sugar Ray Leonard retirements, isn't it? You have to speculate that the charges in Lake Heap accusing him of having doped his way to several of these, to at least one of these titles, has got to be prompting him to, you know, say, all right, I'm going to go out here. You're going to test me for another year. I'm probably going to pass. Now I've got to do this one more time because of something I have to prove to myself and now something I have to prove to you.
Barry Bonds will apparently return to the Giants this weekend. How effective do you think he can be for the remainder of this season?
Not very. I think his knee is shot. I think he's got a Joe Namath knee on his hands. Who knows where his head will be at? Who knows what will happen the first time he hits a home run? It's going to be a circus, but that's a really bad baseball team. And the problem is he will be the only reason people pay attention to the Giants.
And finally, Charlie, the German town of Heilbronn recently hosted the World Dive Bombing Championships. This is an event in which you attempt to create a large splash by jumping into a pool, and then you get extra points for not letting on that it really hurt.
Yes.
Can I sign you up?
Simon Gefeffer, Gefeffer from the Swiss town of Munzingen.
I knew you'd love this story.
A dive comprising four turns before landing on his face. What a waste of time.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
As groomers lie idle and snowmakers stand static in the summer sun, some adventurous skiers are taking to the hills of Virginia with a new brand of ski designed to fly through the fescue and rollick through the rye. From Roanoke, WVTU's Beverly Amsler has this report.
It's a sunny August day, and the mercury is hovering around 90. Bryce Resort, nestled in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, is full of visitors. They're playing golf, splashing on the water slide, and sushing down the bunny slope. It's called grass skiing, and according to officials at the resort, Bryce has the only organized grass skiing program in the country. On this humid day, 11-year-old Hunter Novotny, a snow skier from Plainview, Texas, is getting fitted for grass skis. He puts on regular ski boots, then waits while ski instructor Horst Locker adjusts the tension of the skis. They're between 25 and 31 inches long, weigh 12 to 14 pounds, and look like tank treads. After Hunter is fitted with a helmet, it's time to hit the slopes.
And as I start slowing down, I'm going to make my skis roll farther apart.
Instructor Kathy Hurd Carrillo explains that stopping with grass skis is a lot harder than with the snow skis with which Hunter is familiar. Grass skiing takes a lot of lower body strength, and instead of bringing the knees together to create the snowplow, she lets the skis roll further apart. She gets down into a low kung fu-like stance and tilts the edges of the skis in.
Watch what it looks like.
She says snow skiing is much less strenuous than the grass version.
You're in much lower body position, so you have the strength to handle the turns. The vibration from the ground, all of it comes up through your body. None of it is lost by skidding the ski. So grass skiing makes you much more fatigued. We say 3 hours of grass skiing is like 8 hours of snow skiing.
Grass skis run anywhere from $200 to $500, and they're a bit more dangerous than conventional skis. If a skier hits a racing gate, he or she could jam the ski's moving parts between the footplate and the tread. To prevent this, a Japanese company recently came out with fenders to act as gate deflectors. Grass skiing is very popular in Europe. Horst Locker, a former competitive skier, brought the sport from Germany to Bryce Resort nearly 30 years ago, after a knee injury forced him to quit the sport he loved.
You need the right hill. Most ski areas in summertime, they look not very pretty because they have a lot of eroded places, rocks and ditches, so you cannot do that. And our hill looks almost like a golf course.
He thought the sport would catch on in the U.S. among recreational skiers, but he says that hasn't happened yet.
In Europe and in other parts of the world, the skis got more designed for competition, for the experts, for people who want to get better in ski racing in wintertime, so they practice in summertime certain ski clubs in the alpine countries like Italy, France, Austria, Germany, Switzerland.
Kathy Heard Carrillo is a former professional figure skater. After touring with the Ice Capades and Holiday on Ice in Europe, she came back to Bryce in 1990 to teach skiing. Heard Carrillo would like to see grass skiing become more popular in America as snow skiers train for competition. She says here in the East, you can grass ski for 8 months of the year compared to 4 for snow skiing, and she says it's easier to snow ski once you've learned the basics on grass.
Because with grass skis, you have a great grip all the time, and because you have such a good grip, it's easier to learn the technique of turning and stopping. Therefore, just about every lesson we teach goes up the chairlift and comes down from the top. And snow skiing, you can spend weeks on the beginner area before you're ready to go to the top.
Horst Locker hopes Olympic hopefuls will recognize the potential benefits of grass skiing. He says it might become an Olympic sport if the European countries campaign for it.
A couple of years ago, the World Championship was in Japan. And 3 years ago, it was in Italy. We have been there. And now with China moving in, with everything, also with the Olympics, it could be down the road there will be some championships in China, and then you never know, they can push it for the Olympics.
Back on the bunny hill, Hunter Novotny has finished his lesson. His hair damp and face glistening with sweat, the preteen says he loved it.
It's a lot of work, but it's fun.
And he says he'll try it again.
Yes, I just need to rest a lot.
For Only a Game, I'm Beverly Amsler in Roanoke, Virginia.
Today, the Tournament of Mud Parade will make its somewhat messy way through the normally pristine town of North Conway, New Hampshire. The parade is just one of the many festivities planned for Mudstalgia, the 30th anniversary of the Mud Bowl, one of New Hampshire's dirtiest, if not most beloved, traditions. Joining me now on the line from New Hampshire is Mud Bowl historian Tom Eastman, who writes for the weekly independent newspaper The Mountain Ear. Tom, welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be here, and we've got a great weekend for the Mud.
Well, that is, of course, what we wish to talk about. The weekend's games will be held at the Hogg Coliseum. Can you describe the Coliseum for me and explain how you go about preparing the field each year?
Sure, Bill. It's definitely the world's preeminent Mud football stadium, world-renowned, you could even say, since it is the World Mud Bowl. It's we used to play it in cornfields, and the corn stalks weren't very good on people's bare feet and legs. So 1981, the community came together, and that's kind of like, you know, if you build it, they'll come. And they built this stadium in what was a quagmire of an old swamp. It's an outdoor amphitheater built into the hillside. And we started making the mud on Thursday, and the fire department hooks up the fire hydrant at the top of the field. And they, over the years, they've added some good loam to it. And Osgood Brothers of nearby Freiburg, Maine, tills it up for us. And you want mud that'll be not too soupy so you can't run in it, but if you make it too thick, you've got too much action. So it's a nice, delicate balance.
The preparation sounds like a good deal of work. Wouldn't it be easier to hold the Mud Bowl in the spring when most of New England is, in fact, mud?
Well, that's true, but it'd be awfully cold. And it is our second mud season of the year. Has been ever since 1975, and it extends the summer season for our hospitality businesses up here, and it's also a time when the locals have a chance to let their hair down and get down and dirty and help support a good cause, because we've had all this fun, but we've raised over $400,000 for our respective charities over the past 30 years.
It does, however, sound like a very untidy event. How bad is it?
I was talking to a few press people this week who were planning to come up and cover it, and I told them, definitely wear your war correspondent clothing. As you get down and dirty, you can always tell a rookie correspondent because he's the guy with the clean clothes on. So it gets pretty messy, but we do have tubs on the side of the field for the players to take dips in, and as a press guy, that always makes for some great photos, too. And we have cheerleaders that get into the mud, too.
I'm not even going to ask about that. I'm just going to let that one stand.
Well, how about this, then? we have the world's best and probably only synchronized mud swimmers, too.
Oh.
You know, in the Olympics, when they do the swimming, is it a sport? Is it an art? Well, and mud bowl is definitely an art.
As I mentioned, the theme this year is Mudstalgia. Can you tell me a little about, your favorite tale from Mud Bowl's past?
Well, I think there's a myriad of mud stories, but when I think that I was a 22-year-old college kid covering my first Mud Bowl, and now I'm, as you introduced me, the mud historian. That's quite an honor.
Yes, indeed.
It's not something I set out to be, but someone has to do it. But I think one of my favorite moments was the 16-time champion Muddas in 1985 parked a limousine at the edge of the field, and they put up a blanket behind it.
The old clown car gag.
Exactly.
Excellent.
And then they introduced the star of the show, which was Mr. Bruce Mudstein. Then he came out. And he just led the crowd through a song that I'm sure we'll be hearing again today. But it's, Born in the M.U.D. He did the whole crowd went nuts singing Born in the M.U.D. And I hope that one will be brought back.
Tom Eastman is the grandmaster for today's 24th annual Tournament of Mud Parade. He joined me from Conway, New Hampshire. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks very much. And I hope we get you up here for one of our halftime shows.
Like thunder, the forest re-echoed the sound of the song that they sang as they met. His inamorata adjusted her garter and lifted her voice in duet. Why don't you try it? Mud, mud, glorious mud. Nothing quite like it for cooling the blood. So follow me, follow. Down to the hollow, and there let us wallow in glorious mud.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Parati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to check out the High Pointers, browse Only a Game's show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from High Pointer Dave Coville, who explains the painstaking process by which a state's high point is determined.
This rock here sticks up, 2 feet in the air. It's about 4 feet by 8 foot, and we've decided to call that the high point.
And so we descend from Rhode Island's high point, or thereabouts. Anybody got some oxygen? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Down to the hollow, just beautiful, and there let us wallow in glorious
support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.